President Obama recently dealt with the Crusades at a prayer breakfast in the United States. Instead of tackling radical Islamic terrorism, which is a clear and present danger to all of civilization today, he brought up the Crusades. He brought up something that ended 700 years ago as a justification for what radical Muslims are doing today. So, what did the reformers teach on Islam? In expounding Daniel 9, Martin Luther noted that amongst others, the prophet Daniel was talking about the Muslim Turks, who at that time were invading Europe. In the latter part of their reign, when rebels have become completely wicked, a stern-faced king, a master of intrigue, will arise. He will become very strong, but not by his own power. He will cause astounding devastation. He will cause deceit to prosper, and he will consider himself superior. Do the Muslims not consider themselves superior? Muhammad certainly did. When they feel secure, he will destroy many, and he will take a stand against the prince of princes. Yet he will be destroyed, but not by human power. And this, the reformer Martin Luther is quoting Daniel 9, 23 to 25. Martin Luther wrote that the two regimes, that of the Pope and that of the Turk, are antichrist. The Turk, of course, meaning the Muslims. John Calvin, in a sermon on Deuteronomy 18, maintained Muhammad is one of the two horns of antichrist. Muhammad, the founder of Islam, attempted to impose his religious and political system on all. Men were not permitted to train in the marketplace until they bowed to Mecca. Many would leave some dust on their forehead to indicate that they'd performed their Muslim duty by pressing their forehead into the ground. Some would pick up dust and put it on their forehead to make it look like they'd done it. So the Hadith records an incident where Muhammad challenged an old man who'd bowed in prayer earlier that day. He said, "Have you bowed in prayer yet?" The man bent down, picked up some dust and rubbed it on his forehead by way of a joke, mimicking the practice of so many others in Arabia at that time. At this, the Hadith records that Muhammad had this man executed. He did not have a sense of humor. In his commentaries on Daniel chapter 7, John Calvin puts forward the theory that the Muslim Turks are the little horn that springs up from the beast. As the Turks had conquered much of the old Roman Empire, much of the prophecies concerning Rome could apply to the Muslim world. Islam is one of the two legs of the later Roman Empire described in Daniel 2. So Daniel described the vision that God had given, the head of gold, the shoulders of silver, the stomach of bronze, the legs of iron, the feet of iron and clay. Right? And this symbolized the great empires of the world. From the Babylonian Empire to the Medo-Persian Empire, which was two empires, two shoulders. The Greek Empire, the stomach of bronze. The Roman Empire, the legs of iron. And Rome split into two, the Eastern Empire and the Western Empire. Now you see, as the Pope took over the Western Empire of Rome, and as the Muslims took over the Eastern Empire of Rome, the Byzantine Empire, what they're saying is the legs of this monster, this statue, represent the two legs of the papal kingdom or the Roman Catholic and the other Islam. You see how they apply it. Martin Luther noted that Christ warned about false prophets coming from the desert, and this certainly included Muhammad. You might have heard of Ahmadinejad. Ahmadinejad is the most popular, prolific author in the Muslim world. He has authored vast amounts of books, each of which have been printed in millions of copies. He founded the Islamic Propagation Center International in Durban. I debated Ahmadinejad on a number of occasions. And Ahmadinejad at one point was claiming that Muhammad is prophesied in the Bible. And I said, "I believe it." He said, "You believe that?" And I said, "Yes." He says, "You accept that the Bible speaks of Muhammad?" I said, "Of course." He's very happy. He said, "Would you read it for us?" Read. Jesus warned that many false prophets will arise and deceive many people. He was not happy. But Jesus obviously referred to Muhammad when he spoke of many false prophets. And Martin Luther said, there's no doubt that Jesus' warning about false prophets coming from the desert includes Muhammad. Commenting on 2 Thessalonians 2, John Calvin wrote that the sect of Muhammad is like a raging overflow, which in its violence tore away about half of the church. In his commentary on 1 John 2, Calvin states the Turks have a near idol in the place of God. the rock in the box in Mecca. Martin Luther wrote, who is the liar? It is the man who denies that Jesus is the Christ. Such a man is Antichrist. He denies the Father and the Son. The Mohammedans deny both the fatherhood of God and the deity of Christ. Hence, they are liars. They testify against the truth of God's word. On John, 1 John 4, 3-6, Luther's writing, but every spirit that does not acknowledge Jesus is not from God. This is the spirit of Antichrist. This is how we recognize the spirit of truth and the spirit of error. Calvin notes that Muhammad also claims that he has drawn his dreams only from heaven. False spirits claim the name of God. Martin Luther observed the Muslim Turks want to eradicate the Christians. In the 1637 Calvinist Dort Bible, commentary on Revelation 16, the Muslim nations of the East will unite with one another, the pan-Islamic jihad against the West. The 1643 Westminster Assembly's Larger Catechism, one of the most important statements on the Christian faith, calls on Christians to pray that the kingdom of sin and Satan may be destroyed, that the gospel be propagated throughout the world. In its directory for public worship of God, they instruct congregations to pray for the propagation of the gospel and the kingdom of Christ to all nations, for the conversion of the Jews, for the fullness of the Gentiles, for the fall of Antichrist, for the deliverance of the distressed churches abroad, from the tyranny of the anti-Christian faction. By that they mean the Roman Catholics. Antichrist is the Pope. That's what all the reformers taught. And from the cruel oppressions and blasphemies of the Turk or the Muslims. So continually they are seeing Islam and the papacy are two horns of Antichrist, two legs of the beast. Commenting on Revelation 9, the Dutch Dort Bible of 1637 suggests Muhammad is Apollyon, the Greek word for the Hebrew Abaddon, which means destroyer. Muhammad is the destroyer, Abaddon, Apollyon. And the army of locusts that comes out of the desert, and the army of scorpions are the Arabs, the Saracen armies who wage jihad in Muhammad's name. Now these were standard teachings for centuries. This is what all Protestant churches believed. This is what was taught from the pulpit and the theological colleges. But today I think it's not too well known, is it? This is a chapter in Slavery, Terrorism, Islam book. Actually, it's also a chapter in the Greatest Century of Reformation. It's one of the appendixes in the book on what the reformers taught in Islam. We need to know this because our people are not understanding what the Bible is prophesying concerning Islam. Jonathan Edwards, the first president of the Princeton University in America, he wrote in his History of the Work of Redemption, he's also famous for preaching the Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God sermon, one of the most famous sermons in history, out of which the Great Evangelical Awakening was inspired. Jonathan Edwards said, the two great works of the devil which he has wrought against the kingdom of Christ are his anti-Christian or Romanish or papal kingdom, in other words, Roman Catholicism under the Pope, and the Mohammedan, Muslim, or Islamic kingdoms, which have been in slot two kingdoms of great extent and strength, two horns of Antichrist, two legs of the beast, Islam and the papacy. Both together swallow up the ancient Roman Empire. The papal kingdom of Antichrist swallows up the Western Empire. Satan's Mohammedan kingdom swallows up the Eastern Roman Empire, what became the Byzantine Empire. Do you see that? The prophecy of Daniel 2, the two legs of the beast. The Catholics took over the western side of the empire. The Muslims took over the eastern side of the empire. Two legs of the beast, two horns of Antichrist. In the book of Revelation 16-20, it is the destruction of these that the glorious victory of Christ at the introduction of the glorious times of the church will mainly consist. So he's pointing out that the book of Revelation is describing the destruction of the papal Antichrist system and the Islamic system. That is what God is going to destroy. The stone that the builders rejected as worthless strikes the base of the statue, and that the statue crumbles to dust, and the wind blows the dust away, and the stone grows to be a mountain that fills the whole earth. You recall that part of the vision? You've got the a stone, there's a statue, and a stone cut out of life, human hand, strikes the base of the statue, and all the kingdoms of the world crumble to dust. You've read it in Revelation, in Daniel 2. And that stone grows to be a mountain that fills the whole earth. The kingdom of Christ will destroy and replace all these kingdoms of the world, all the Muslim and papist systems. In a sermon on 2 Timothy 1 verse 3, John Calvin exclaimed, "The Turks to this day can allege and say to themselves, 'We serve God from our ancestors.' It is a good time ago, since Muhammad gave them the cup of his devilish dreams to drink, and they got drunk with it. It is about 1,000 years since those cursed hellhounds were made drunk with their follies. Let us be wise and discreet, for otherwise we shall be like the Turks and the heathen." Oh, we need preachers like this in our churches today, do we not? To name names, to sound the trumpet clearly, to identify Islam as the threat that the scripture talks of. By God's grace, we are living in momentous times, which I believe could be the beginning of the end of Islam. Notice the most severe persecutors of the church today are Muslim countries. Saudi Arabia, Maldives, Western Sahara, Iran, Afghanistan, Somalia. Terrible persecutions going on in Muslim countries. The worst persecutions in the world are taking place in Muslim or communist countries. And radical Muslim extremists are the most vicious terrorists, hijackers, kidnappers, suicide bombers, and assassins in the world today. Today, despite Muslims only being 1/5 of the world's population, Muslim armies and terrorist groups are involved in 95% of the wars. They're only 1/5 of the world's population, but they make up 95% of wars in the world today. That's why we must pray for the Muslim world. All these evils are taking place in areas where the church has done the least about of missions and evangelism. We must dare to be a Daniel. Because today we have got Muslim terrorists rising up all over North Africa, threatening churches. Just think of what happened in Paris recently, beginning of this year. Journalists are murdered in Paris. The same week that 2,000 Christians are murdered in Nigeria by Boko Haram. But how much news coverage went for the murders in Nigeria? The French magazine Charlie Hebdo is a dirty, vile, blasphemous, scurrilous piece of filth and trash for people who've got no standards. It's filled with low, degrading, disgusting kinds of cartoons, mostly against Jesus Christ and against God. But when they got shot up by Muslim terrorists, and of course that's disgusting. We don't support terrorism or murder for any reason. And while the Charlie Hebdo magazine was vile and disgusting, the terrorists who attacked them were also. And here, blatantly, openly, they just walked around murdering not just the journalists, but policemen and people at nearby stores. And this got a lot of media coverage. For days, that was the main news. Charlie Hebdo. And the flowers poured in, the condolences poured in. People marched. 3.7 million people marched in Paris in solidarity, including the heads of over 40 countries. Marched in Paris in solidarity for these blasphemous antichrist journalists who were murdered by these wicked Muslim terrorists. Who's marched for the Christians being murdered in Syria and Libya and Egypt and Iraq, northern Nigeria? On the same week that that happened, here you can see what it looked like before from satellite imagery, healthy trees and in red, and here you can see the burned out area. Raised structures. The town of Baga destroyed. 2,000 civilians in Nigeria murdered, machine gunned, rocketed. Media gave no attention to it. It would seem that journalists are more valuable than African Christians. Christians are being attacked in Pakistan, murdered all over the Muslim world. And it didn't just start with Osama bin Laden and the World Trade Center. There's been a massive increase since then, but since 2011, even more so, since the so-called Arab Spring. And many Muslims claim that this is what the Quran teaches, behead the infidel. Now, I want you to have a good look at this picture. Here's a child who is caught stealing in a marketplace. So they call the people together, and they're going to crush this child's arm under the card time while this man is speaking on the microphone. Look at this picture that the little boy having his arm crushed so cold-bloodedly in public. This is Sharia law. The Middle East is full of this kind of violence. Wherever Islam reaches the rest of the world, you see violence. And they keep telling us the peaceful and tolerant religion. Yet you can see what's happening. Islam is coming down like a wave of blood upon our country. Even Kenya and Tanzania are having Muslim terrorist attacks and ministers being murdered. Sudan, praise God, South Sudan is now free and independent, but South Kordofan, Nub Mountains, they're Christians in the Blue Nile and Nub Mountains on the wrong side. So while South Sudan has its freedom, the people in who are still Christians, black African Christians who should be in South Sudan, they're on the wrong side of the border north and they're still being bombed now in Nub Mountains. The South has gone through a lot of attacks over the years. Since 1955, the Muslim North was waging war against Christians in the South. Our mission has been seeking to serve the Christians there, but in the Nuba Mountains and Blue Nile, the people are still suffering. They're being bombed and attacked. In the latest Frontline Fellowship news, we're giving updates on the offensives against Christians in Nuba Mountains now. Christians having to hide in the caves while their towns and villages and homes and fields are being bombed. We need to be alert to what's going on with Christians around the world under attack. Who's marching for them? In Nigeria, Boko Haram has been attacking Christians. Now, we are told that Boko Haram means Western education is sacrilege. But that's just not true. Haram means forbidden. Boko means Bible. It can only mean Bible. It's two simple words, Boko Haram. In Arabic, Boko means the Bible, the people of the book. And Haram is forbidden. We know what halal is. Halal means permitted. So halal food is permitted food. A Muslim prepared it. A Muslim packaged the food. A Muslim prayed over it. And so you pay more money for halal food because they're paying certification. If you buy halal food, you're subsidizing Islam. But haram is forbidden. So Boko Haram means the Bible is forbidden. And journalists and Christians even lie and tell you Boko Haram means Western education is forbidden. How does Boko become Western education? It's four letters. It's one word. It only means Bible. Boko Haram means the Bible is forbidden. And this Boko Haram, notice how they're now using the Shahada, the flag of which has got the Islamic declaration of there's no God but Allah and Muhammad is his prophet. And they've also got the crossed Kalashnikovs. Two AK-47s, an open Quran with a Shahada, white text on black flag. This is Boko Haram, anti-Christian, in a nation where most of the people are meant to be Christians. Nigeria is meant to be a majority Christian country. But in a 12 northernmost states, these 12 states, they've declared Sharia law. And so while Muslims are the minority of the total country, they are the majority in the north, and they've declared Sharia law, and that's where most of Boko Haram's activities are taking place, northeast of the country. Churches being destroyed. Do you know how many churches have been destroyed in Nigeria in the last 5 years? 1,000. 1,000 churches have been destroyed in northern Nigeria in the last 5 years, and 16,000 Christians murdered. 16,000 Christians murdered in the last 5 years by this Boko Haram. Islamic terrorists who are very much affiliated with Al-Shabaab in Kenya and Somalia and with this ISIS in the Middle East. These terrorists are getting lots of weapons in oil producing countries, and with car bombs and terror attacks and suicide bombings, they're murdering our brethren in Nigeria. They are kidnapping Christian girls and selling them into slavery. We need to stand up against this. But what does the American president do? He blames the Crusades, which ended 700 years ago. What has that got to do with anything? But he says nothing against Islamic Jihad. This is a car bomb. This is what. Imagine what the bomb does to the people. That's what it does to the vehicle. Can you imagine? Suicide bomb in a car that drove into a church. Churches attacked all over Nigeria. 1,000 churches destroyed in 5 years in Nigeria. But who is standing with the Nigerians? It seems journalists in Paris are more valuable than Christians in Africa. In Zinder, the second largest city in Nigeria, in Niger, On Friday the 16th of January, the mosques whipped up their people to hysteria about the Charlie Hebdo blasphemy against Muhammad, and they went out and they burned 70 churches, burning people to death. 70 churches. That's about all the churches left. Because only 0.3% of the population of Niger are Christians. Christians are a very small community, and they shattered. But what do Christians in Niger have to do with blasphemy in Paris by a bunch of atheists? What possible blame can fall on the Christians in Niger? What did they do to deserve this? But the Muslims are not thinking logically. Somebody must die, even if it's someone who had nothing to do with it. Christians in Egypt, under terrible attack. St. Mark planted the church in Egypt 2,000 years ago. Church has gone through 14 centuries of Islamic persecution. The Christians in Egypt are tenacious. They are tough. They've put up with a lot of violence and persecution. Car bombs, terror attacks, assassinations, kidnappings. This poor girl, Mary George, 25 years old, was stabbed 16 times, strangled to death, her car set on fire by Muslims for no other reason than she is a Christian. Christian children being kidnapped in Egypt. We need to stand up and speak out on behalf of our Christian brothers and sisters in Egypt. In one weekend, just one weekend last year, we saw over 70 churches destroyed in Egypt in the space of one weekend by the Muslim Brotherhood, who is supported by the American government. And did the American president speak out against this kind of violence? No, never. He speaks against Christians. He doesn't speak against Islamic terrorism. The American president is Antichrist. He is against Christ and he is for Islam. He has unleashed this Muslim Brotherhood, this Arab Spring in the Middle East. The American State Department encouraged it, funded it, helped to topple their friends and ally, Mubarak's government, which was stable in Egypt for years, and have fueled and funded the Muslim Brotherhood, who are one of the most radical terrorist groups in the Middle East. The Muslim Brotherhood birthed Hamas, Hezbollah, Al-Qaeda, and ISIS. The Muslim Brotherhood assassinated the Egyptian president Anwar Sadat back in 1981 because he signed a peace treaty with Israel. And yet the American government calls the Muslim Brotherhood a force for peace and moderation. I mean, can anyone take the American government seriously when they lie like that? The Bible Society in Egypt, burned out by the Muslim Brotherhood. Churches that have stood for 1,000 years and more, burned out. Magnificent churches. Many, many martyrs. Many people have lost their lives. These are some of the martyrs in Egypt who've been murdered for the Christian faith. We must stand with our Christian brothers wherever they're persecuted. Now, I know some people say, oh, but they're Copts. I know the Copts are not Protestants. I'm for the Reformation. I want to see the Coptic churches evangelized, discipled, reformed, and revived. But they're suffering for Christ. And even though they have icons which we don't agree with, and they do things in a more ritualistic fashion than we do, but still they're suffering for Christ. We should stand with them. Because when a person suffers for Christ, then they are our brother. Look at this, standing in the ruins of their beautiful church. Friends of mine sent me a card saying, they may destroy our churches, but they can never destroy our faith. That needs to be our attitude. We need to stand firm. The church is not buildings. The church is people, redeemed people, born again people. Now, why is Islam doing this? They're doing this because they're losing. They're losing the battle. In Nigeria, Christians are growing faster than Muslims. Muslims are coming to Christ. Thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Muslims have come to Christ in Nigeria in recent years. The churches being attacked are mostly churches with lots of Muslims in them. Converted Muslims. And this is why they're getting so violent, because they can't win an argument, they can only turn to violence. When a person starts to swear at you or attack you or attack your character or try to use violence, it means they've lost the argument. Because if they could argue logically, they would keep talking logically. But they can't win the debate because the Quran is worthless and their arguments of Islam don't hold water, and they cannot stand up to the facts of Christianity, and so they're using violence. It just proves that they've lost. In Iraq, churches attacked, Christians murdered. Do you know that not long ago, one out of every 6 people in Iraq was a Christian? 1 out of 6. Today, there's not even 200,000 Christians left in Iraq. When the Americans took Iraq in 2003, there were 1.3 million Christians still in Iraq. Today there's not even 200,000. More than a million Christians have fled Iraq in recent years because they found liberation and democracy worse than the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein. They were safer under Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein wasn't good, but he didn't persecute the church. But the Muslim democracy that Americans have installed has proved to be a greater disaster than anything they've ever suffered before. And today we have ISIS. And ISIS is funded by America. You know that Ambassador Stevens of the Americans was murdered in Benghazi in Libya a few years ago? He helped fund ISIS and got them $500 million and helped arm them. The arms that killed him, he helped supply. It's a matter of what you sow is what you reap. Today, ISIS is on the march, and they not only have lots of weapons provided by the Americans, but they've got lots of stockpiles of American four-wheel drive vehicles and Humvees and all kinds of great weaponry. Thank you, America, for supplying and arming the worst anti-Christian terrorist group in the world today. They walk around smashing graveyards, destroying Christian markers. No respect, even for the dead. And they're demolishing tombs. Tombs. Tombs of prophets. The prophet Jonah and the prophet Daniel. They've smashed and demolished and blown up their tombs. Can you imagine? Destroying history. This is a war against civilization. It's a war against history. It's a war against Christianity. It's a war against God itself. ISIS is going around demolishing here the tomb of Daniel. Terrible to think that they can destroy things like this. And the tomb of Jonah going up there. Smashing statues, smashing, destroying, blowing up and burning. This is what Islam can do for a city. That is the flag of ISIS. This is their map. I want you to notice. They think Ethiopia should be part of their caliphate. They think Kenya should be part of the caliphate. They think Uganda should be part of the caliphate. They think Gambia should be part of the caliphate. Nigeria, Cameroon, Central African Republic. All of it, they're claiming for Islam. Even Spain. Even Austria and Hungary and Romania and Greece. India. This is what they want. This is ISIS' goal. The caliphate. Who founded ISIS? Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who was a prisoner of the Americans. George Bush's army caught him, but Obama released him. One of the first things Obama did in 2009 was release this Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who then went and founded ISIS. Many people say America didn't just fund them, but actually founded them. This man is actually working for the American government to found ISIS. Because Obama is a secret Muslim, many believe. In fact, that makes sense, because no Muslim is allowed to ever leave Islam. And no Muslim is allowed to have a meal with someone who is an ex-Muslim. There's no such thing as an ex-Muslim or a lapsed Muslim according to Islam. You're an apostate worthy of death. And every Muslim on earth is obligated to kill you. They certainly cannot shake your hand or eat with you, right? If you're an ex-Muslim. Barack Hussein Obama, whose father, whose biological father is Muslim, whose adopted father was Muslim, who claims he was a Muslim when he went to Muslim school in Indonesia, he claims he's a lapsed Muslim. If that is so, then he is an apostate worthy of death according to Islam, and every Muslim on earth would be obligated to kill him. But 98% of all Muslims in America voted for Obama. Twice. Can they believe Obama's an ex-Muslim? No, they cannot. The Muslims in America could not have voted for him if they believed that he was an ex-Muslim. They've got to believe he's a deception operation. He's a Trojan horse. A fake who pretends to be a Christian but is actually a Muslim. They must believe it. Or they wouldn't have voted for him. And he's been received. Obama's been received by the King of Saudi Arabia and many who he bowed before. Imagine an American president bowing to the bandit of Saudi Arabia. And so, all the Muslim countries that have received Obama, they can't believe he's an ex-Muslim, or they wouldn't have received him. They must believe he's really one of them. But look at his actions. He's allowed Iraq, which America under Bush apparently liberated, to become more Islamic and more extreme than ever was before. And a lot of their weapons come from America, and their funding comes from America. And many of them are actually Americans as well. There's 1,500 British citizens fighting in ISIS. There's only 500 Muslims in the whole British army, but there's 1,500 British citizens fighting in ISIS, if that can make sense to you. And what happens to the woman when Muslims take over? They get put into the burqas. And why do women have to wear a burqa in the Muslim world? To hide the bruises and the black eyes and the broken noses. Because Islam teaches that you can beat your wives. In fact, it recommends it. That's why you even have the screen that you can't even see the eyes in some cases. Under Islam, the woman is always to blame. The Muslims teach that a woman is 90% to blame if she is raped. 90%. The rapist only has 10% to blame. Whereas the woman has the power of seduction and enticement, and therefore the woman is always to blame. So in Pakistan, a woman who is raped is buried up to her waist and stoned to death. In Afghanistan, a woman who is raped is shot in the head. This at football, see the football field lines? During halftime, they brought up this woman shot in the head because she had been raped. This woman, Naron, hung because she's a victim of rape. They execute the victim, not the rapist. This woman had her nose cut off by her husband, but he's not punished because under Islam, the man can do what he wants, apparently. This woman is one of 5,000 women a year in the Muslim world who gets acid thrown in their face for not wearing a veil. Acid. 5,000 a year this happens. So what happens when women are captured in Islam? They might end up in a cage being sold in a slave market in the Middle East. The normal people in the West who get converted to Islam, and then what happens? This man used to be a doctor saving lives, and then he decided, why save lives when I can take lives, and he's become a terrorist for Islam. He's joined ISIS. They cut off people's hands in Islam. They stone people to death. This is part of Sharia law. They execute people, public executions. In many cases, these are Muslims killing Muslims, but they're the wrong kind of Muslims. ISIS are more extreme, and there's other Muslims who they think aren't serious enough. Shooting people in the back. Imagine shooting an unarmed person in the back while they're lying on the ground. Beating people because they're Protestant in Pakistan. And now crucifixions. Christians being crucified, nailed up on crosses. ISIS posts these pictures showing them crucifying Christians in public. And what the Muslims doing, they're standing around taking pictures with their cell phones. Now there are people in the West, all over America and Britain and other places in the world, buying I am ISIS t-shirts. We are all ISIS. These are people who stoned people to death, cut off limbs, crucified people, beheaded people, and people want to wear t-shirts saying I'm ISIS. And they walk in the streets of New York with behead all those who insult the Prophet. Do you know what this symbol is? This is N in Arabic. The U with a dot on it, that is an N in Arabic. It stands for Nazarene. And so what the Muslims are doing is they're marking the homes of Christians with this N. And it's basically saying this is a real Christian. Now you get Christians and then you get Nazarenes. And what they mean is these are really serious Christians. They're a threat. In the communist world in Eastern Europe, they used to refer to the real Christians as repenters. A Christian might just be a churchgoer, but a repenter is a real Christian. Now, isn't that interesting that they would distinguish between those who are just nominal Christians and those who are serious Christians? So if the Muslims were to identify who the real Christians were in your area, how many of your church members would get this sign? What kind of people point a gun in the face of a little child? And so what you're seeing in the Middle East right now is genocide, real genocide. They are wiping out Christians from the heartland. Remember, there have been Christians in Iraq and Syria and Egypt since the first century, since the time of the apostles. And they've been chased out. Today there are, for the first time in 2,000 years, no Christians in Nineveh or Mosul. And don't just think this is a Muslim Middle East. It even comes to Kenya. Any of you here from Kenya? Yeah. You all know Westgate Mall, I'm sure. I've been there. Our missionaries use it. Many expatriates do when they pass it through. It's a lot of things you get there. Next to Kenya, Somalia, which is 99% Muslim. Al-Shabaab are the main terrorists in Somalia. And this is what they've managed to do to that country. This is the capital city of Somalia, Mogadishu. You see the minaret. By the way, I don't know if you can see the South African Casper armored cars. South Africa provides the African Union with the vehicles they're using for their peacekeeping operations in Mogadishu. But not much peace they're keeping, because Al-Shabaab is causing havoc. And we know of, in 1 year, 12 Somalian Muslims who were converted to Christ who were stoned to death or beheaded in 1 year. Like this man. Buried up to his waist and stoned to death for being an apostate, for converting to Christianity. So, you know what Muslims do with people who leave their religion. So why do you think Obama could be an ex-Muslim when he's treated with such friendliness by so many Muslims around the world and in America? Al-Shabaab is on the march, and they're well armed, and they are flying the same flag as ISIS now. There's obviously an affiliation growing between them and ISIS. They are saying they want to shoot down aircraft. They are making it clear their goal is to invade Kenya. In fact, I don't know if you've seen their posting. This is what's going on. While the people in Kenya are being disarmed by their own government, Al-Shabaab is saying, inshallah, we shall enter Nairobi. They are wanting to conquer a Christian country on their neighbors. So Kenya is being targeted. And Kenya has had a lot of attacks already. Back in 1998, the Muslims bombed the American embassy, but they actually killed a lot of Kenyans who had nothing to do with the American embassy around it. This block of flats was next to the American embassy, and every window is blown out there. Now, grenades being thrown into churches, and churches are being targeted. And Westgate Mall, absolutely terrible. The Muslims targeted this most prominent and probably the best shopping center in the whole of East Africa, I think. And they turned this into a war zone. This is now devastated. They came in from the bottom and they came in from the top. They came in from the parking lot at the top and through the front entrance. And the people, of course, are disarmed. People in Kenya are normally disarmed. They're peaceful people. And so the Somalian terrorists are walking around with the AK-47 assault rifles, just shooting at people very calmly, being able to fight all over. Now, this is security people trying to respond, police coming in, the whole area being shot up. A lot of foreigners, a lot of expatriates, non-governmental organization groups in Nairobi, and they would use Westgate Mall. And that was the goal. The goal of the terrorists is to strike a public area and create as much havoc and confusion as possible. Just think how many people's lives are wrecked, broken, families torn apart, loved ones killed, injured, crippled, maimed during this hideous attack on Westgate Mall. This is what terrorism aims to do. This is what Al-Shabaab did to Kenya at the Westgate Mall. Murdering people in cold blood are just coming there to the shops. And now just look at this and think, when these things happen, what does the American president do? He blames the Crusades. He blames something that happened 700 years ago in reaction to 5 centuries of Islamic Jihad. And we would like to say that all the terrorists were caught or killed, but unfortunately, a lot of them got away. This is Westgate Mall. They approached from the rooftop at the top and through the main entrance. They attacked them both ways. They came from top down, from bottom up, and caught the people in the middle. And the army in the end came in by helicopters and used a lot of explosions to get them out. And it's just absolutely nightmarish. Most people are not prepared for terrorism. Most people are not trained as to how to respond. Most of the police and army don't know how to deal with this kind of hostage situation either. As this developed and started, Britain offered the Special Air Service and the Germans offered GSG-9, Schutzgruppe 9, to come in and help clear out the terrorists, because they've practiced and specialized in it over the years. But for whatever reason, the Kenyan government did not accept that offer. And so this carried on for over 72 hours. This went on for days. People trying to escape out of different parts of it, as the Muslims went from one part to the other through Westgate Mall, murdering people. And it was a mess. Because there's a casino and there's banks which had armored glass and strong vaults where they could hide in. And it was very hard to get them out of the shopping center. Because shopping centers are designed for ease of access for the people, not for defensive operations. And the casualties just kept mounting up. The Muslims were able to cause havoc. So finally, they sent an army. But unfortunately, the Kenyan army mainly seemed to have shot plainclothes policemen, and so they pulled them out because they had trouble telling the difference between a civilian policeman carrying a weapon and a Somalian terrorist, it would seem. So in that chaotic situation, unfortunately there was too many friendly fire incidents where individuals were killed who were actually on our side. And this kept dragging on. Just when you thought it's got to be over, more fighting and more explosions would erupt. But amazingly, the terrorists escaped, or at least many of them escaped. And the reason for this is that every now and then, people fled out of different places where they had been hiding. And unfortunately, they weren't all screened as they came out, and the terrorists came out amongst some of them, left their weapons and changed their clothes and came out pretending to be hostages. And so most of the terrorists, when they cleared their way through the whole place, they found that a whole lot of the terrorists had actually escaped amongst those groups that were coming out. This was described in the media as a hostage situation. That's not true. There never were any hostages taken. Al-Shabaab killed everyone they came across. The fact that some people were still hiding in the shopping mall in different places, you could have called them hostages, but not really. If the Muslims saw them, they killed them. And so this was not a hostage situation at all. It was just a straight terrorist attack. But they organized it in such a way that they could still escape. And despite being surrounded, they came out in bits and pieces amongst the people who were fleeing out of this chaos. And damage done was mostly by the security forces trying to get the Muslims out. Because they weren't sure what to do, they started detonating and blowing up one off the other shop. And the shops, most of the damage got done in the military retaking of the shopping center. We're not talking about millions of dollars damage. We're talking about billions of dollars damage. And many shops said that they were looted by the police and army, computers, cell phones. The terrorists couldn't have taken them because they didn't have, well, everyone who came out with nothing on them. But they say that most of the looting took place during the security force operations. And this is what it looks like now. Destroyed, wrecked, blown out, bombed out. This bombing on the top part of the parking area was done by the security forces to try and retake the place. Just think how many people's vehicles, businesses, life savings, destroyed. This is the aftermath of Islam in Nairobi. And people keep wanting to tell us Islam is a peaceful and tolerant religion. Imagine if they were violent. So I'm showing you these pictures because we need to recognize that this is not just a threat for the Muslim world. It's happening in even the Christian parts of Africa too. They can come and attack, and we need to be alert and we need to be ready and we need to be prepared. There's a lot of suffering that comes as a result of it. But does Obama condemn the terrorism? No, he never condemns Islamic terrorism. He condemns the Christians. One of our friends, James Thomas, was one of the first people killed. He's the one South African who died in this terrorist attack in Nairobi. He might have been the very first person killed, but he certainly won the first. James Thomas runs the Cape Town Youth Choir, which my daughter is part of. And he's a very fine, evangelical, dedicated Christian, a man who's a philanthropist. He is involved in relief projects, uplifting poor people in Kenya. And he is there on effectively a missionary activity when he is murdered by these Muslim terrorists in the shopping mall. That's just one personal family contact we had in the Westgate attack. Now, these are some of the terrorists they did capture. And you'll notice, no remorse, no sense of shame or guilt for what they did. These Somalians are just proud and arrogant. Because after all, they're just doing what the Prophet did. They are just following the example of Muhammad. They're following the teaching of the Quran. And so they feel quite arrogant and full of themselves. And they can walk in public saying, behead those who insult Islam. Massacre those who insult Islam. For world peace, Israel must be destroyed. Death to all Jews. I think they need some teaching on spelling. Democracy is cancer. Islam is the answer. Democracy is the cause of oppression. Can you not just feel the tolerance? These are the kind of people we often have to debate with. Exterminate those who slander Islam. Behead those who insult Islam. Freedom, go to hell. Now how eloquent can that be? It's no wonder that William Muir, one of the greatest Orientalists of all time, concluded at the end of his long and distinguished career, "The sword of Muhammad and of Islam are the most fatal enemies of civilization, liberty, and truth which the world has ever known. An unmitigated cultural disaster parading as God's will." Winston Churchill, the British Prime Minister, wrote, "How dreadful are the curses which Muhammadanism lays on its supporters. Besides the fanatical frenzy, which is dangerous in a man as rabies in a dog, there is this fearful, fatalistic apathy. The effects are apparent in many countries. Improvident habits, slovenly systems of agriculture, sluggish methods of commerce, insecurity of property exist. A degraded sensualism deprives this life of its grace and refinement, and the next of its dignity and sanctity. The fact is that in Mohammedan law, every woman belongs to some man as absolute property. Unless Islam is extinguished as a great power amongst men, slavery cannot be extinguished." Slavery and Islam go together. Until Islam ceases to be a great power amongst men, there will continue to be slavery, because they enslave women. Individual Muslims may show splendid qualities, but the influence of the religion paralyzes the social development of those who follow it. No stronger retrograde force exists in the world. Far from being moribund, Mohammedanism is a militant and proselytizing faith, and it's spread throughout Central Africa. Were it not that Christianity is sheltered in the strong arms of science, the science against which Islam had vainly struggled, the civilization of modern Europe might fall, as fell the civilization of ancient Rome. That's what Winston Churchill, the Prime Minister of Britain, had to say about Islam. Today you have the Muslims arrogantly putting up their prayer gatherings, as they call them, in the streets of New York and London, blocking traffic. Why would you block traffic to pray? We have prayer meetings without blocking traffic. You don't need to pray at an intersection of a main road. You can do it in a park or in a church or hire a hall. But no, the Muslims want to block traffic because their prayer is nothing spiritual. It's entirely a political demonstration. It's meant to intimidate people. On the 11th of November, the English-speaking world remembers those who died in the First and Second World Wars, the millions of soldiers who died in the wars. The poppy is the flower that symbolizes the soldiers who died in the wars, because on their graves grew many poppies. And the Muslims decide on 11th of November to march and to say, "Massacre those who insult Islam. Europe, you will pay. Your 9/11 is on its way. British soldiers burn in hell. Our dead are in paradise. Your dead are in hell." Sharia for Britain. Be prepared for the real Holocaust. And then they burned a poppy. Why would they do that? And then they attacked the police. Now this is the kind of thing that we're getting used to. And don't be surprised if a new crusade arises one of these days, because we cannot continue to be just victims of the attacks of Islam. It's about time for us to start to fight back. We should understand why the Crusaders attacked Islam, because they were under this kind of provocation beforehand. The Crusades were nothing other than a reaction to centuries of Islam. So ISIS murders thousands of people, but what is our media? Hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil. This is typical of our media today. They're like these three monkeys. They're not wanting to report on anything that Islam does. And in fact, the media ignores the bloody hands of Islam and tries to paint them as peaceful, tolerant, with the dove of peace. But that's what they want. They want a piece of your country. How many of your countries are in that caliphate they're referring to there? And now what's happening to the Christians in the Middle East? Fleeing. While the American government and the Saudi Arabian government are arming and training these people. What is ISIS? ISIS are the Syrian rebels who America and the CIA and Saudi Arabia were funding and arming last year. The Muslims are doing very well, thank you. Why are they eating so well? Because we are still using oil. Every third barrel of oil goes to weapons in the Middle East. We need to move to alternative source of energy. If we can get off oil, Islam will go back to the Stone Age. So, what I want to do is help you to understand the Crusades. And I've got that over here. Are there any questions on this section of ISIS first? Yes? Yes.
What happened? I don't know whether these people really understand what it means to be communist Muslims. They were going around killing all the Christians. And then also, in the case of Dubai, anytime Israel have a problem fighting with Palestine, Americans always support Israel. And you will see, in the case of Iran, this ISIS, America, they are not doing anything. What is the real secret behind this? America standing for Israel and not standing for the leaders. Because what happened, even in the UN, when they were voting against Israel, that Israel actually terrorized Palestine. America was the only nation that did not vote against Israel. So what is the real thing behind this?
Yes. I think that's an important question. Well, in 1914, we'll look at this a bit tomorrow. In 1914, Christian nations ruled the world. Protestant, Catholic, or Orthodox, but Christian nations ruled the world, with the exception of Japan, China, and the Ottoman Empire. But the rest of the world was under Christian nations, to some degree or another, Catholic, Protestant, Orthodox. Today, I don't know if there's one country that can call itself truly Christian, with a Christian government that really honors and respects Christ and tries to base their laws in the Bible. And it's because of the First World War, and we'll get there. But the bankers, mostly Jewish. Hollywood's mostly Jewish. Almost all the media in America, newspapers, magazines, TV, is controlled by the Jews. So don't be surprised if the Americans are always doing what the Jews want them to do, which is support Israel, amongst other things. And of course, create massive amounts of debt to keep the people enslaved to the banks. So there is that problem. And I am shocked at how many Christians worship Israel and idolize Israel when they're totally oblivious to and unconcerned about the Christians being murdered. The Christians marching for Israel. Israel's got an army, and a very good big army. Israel has embassies, and they have a lot of money. In fact, Israel gets most of the foreign aid in the world today. All the foreign aid in the world, one third goes to Israel. All the foreign aid from all sources. They get billions and billions and billions of dollars every year from Germany and America alone, and others. So Israel is doing just fine. And Israel's in no danger. Israel's got a great army, and they've got a tremendous public relations system, and Hollywood's on their side, and they've got media, and they've got their own embassies. But who speaks up for the Christians in the Middle East? Who's speaking up for the Christians in Iraq and Syria, northern Nigeria? Who's speaking up for the Christians in Somalia and in Ethiopia being murdered? And who speaks up for the Christians who are being attacked in the Nub Mountains? It's scandalous. And so I do believe that this is a shocking situation that we've got, where the average Christian today, an American, is more concerned for Israel than are for the persecuted church. And when you look in the Bible, all the prophets condemned sin in Israel. The state that's around there right now They're not even a biblical state. They don't even worship the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They are a secular state with legalized abortion, legalized pornography, women being drafted into the army. Conscripted in the army. Women being conscripted into the army? I mean, Israel today is not a biblical state. It's not like what King David ran. And yet, there are Christians who idolize them, but which prophet gave Israel a blank check or a free pass? You read the prophets. Every prophet condemned Israel and Judea for their sin, for their idolatry, for their immorality, for their injustice, for their interfaith activity. And all the prophets warned them that you will be destroyed and dispersed if you do not obey God. And yet today, you'd think, if you're a Jew or if you're Israel, yay, you get a free pass. But no prophet spoke like that. The prophet said, to whom much is given, much is required. To whom much more is given, much more is required. Israel should be turning to God. We need to be seeking to win Israelis to Christ and get the Jews to come to Christ and recognize the Messiah and submit to him. But instead, there's many Christians who think they must support the political agenda of Israel. But we aren't called to support the political agenda of any secular state, even if they do call themselves Israel. It's not real Israel. Israel means God's people, and people who are in what's called Israel today are not God's people. Most of them are not Christians. They don't believe the Messiah. They do not worship Christ. In fact, many of them actually persecute Christians. So I think this is a bit bizarre. We've got this ridiculous situation in the world where most of the wars in the world are caused by either the Muslims or the Jews. And so you've got the Jewish bankers and Jewish Hollywood and the Muslim terrorists. Between them, the sons of Ishmael and of Jacob are causing a lot of our troubles in the world today. And as Christians, we need to have a higher agenda. We serve Christ. We should stand with our brothers and sisters in Christ who suffer. Yes. Shadow of doubt, and you will see when I give you the book Slavery, Terrorism, Islam, that all these terrorist movements from ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Muslim Brotherhood, Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, they all come from the mosque. They come from teachings on the Quran. They come from Muslim communities, mosques, and they tend to be the most serious Muslims. These are not the backsliders who never attend mosque on Friday, who don't study the Quran. These are the most serious ones. So just as a serious Christian who studies the Bible becomes an evangelist, a missionary, a witness, seeks to help and serve other people and might open hospitals and schools, the most serious Muslims tend to become terrorists, car bombers, suicide bombers, kidnappers and so on, because that's what Muhammad did. Their prophet is not the same as ours. Our Lord Jesus never kidnapped anyone. Our Lord Jesus never enslaved anyone. Our Lord Jesus set the captives free. He healed the sick. He raised the dead. Muhammad killed people, crippled people, enslaved people. Muhammad raped people. Muhammad taught that you could rape captive women, that you could sell your slave girls as prostitutes. Muhammad married an underage girl. Aisha was 6 years old when he married her, 9 years old when he consummated the marriage, he said. According to his own testimony, that is statutory rape. That is child abuse. That is pedophilia. And so Islam's prophet, that's his example. So if you're following Muhammad, then you might look a bit more like ISIS. But if you're following Jesus, you're going the other direction.
Just a question. Is it that the reason why they don't want people to portray Muhammad's image or so many that's why they don't want to Is it because of what he did? They don't want to do anything.
It could be, yeah. Yeah. Nothing can depict Muhammad, they say. But honestly, Islam is not a religion as much as a cult. It's a death cult. It's a political, violent, terrorist cult. Yes.
My question is, you know, the thing that the Catholic raised Islam to be able to control the real Christian. According to your historical background, the incident that Khadija was a Catholic, and later when she was wrong to God's mission, and used Muhammad to make it happen.
Okay, I've heard that. I don't think that that's very seriously to be considered. Chick publications. Yeah. There are some... Jack Chick has some good comics for evangelism, but he does not understand its history. And you could say that the failure of the Catholic Church led to the rise of Islam. But to say that the Catholic Church planned Islam and launched it seems a bit foolish. And there's a lot of good enough explanations what started Islam without it being started by the Catholic Church. And of course the Catholic Church suffered quite a lot at the hands anyway. So, no, I don't accept what Jack Chick suggests, that Catholicism started Islam. But I would blame Catholicism to an extent, because if they had been a true Christian church and had been doing what they're meant to do, Islam could not have arisen. To a large extent, the failure of the Catholic Church and its descent into apostasy enabled Islam to rise because of the spiritual vacuum they left. Any other comments or questions?
Yeah, my comment on this is that Islam itself, the foundation of Islam, it was on violence, killing the people. If you refuse to come to Muhammad and to follow Muhammad, you must die. And this, now they believe that if you kill someone who is not a Muslim, that Allah will reward you in the end of the days. And this is what now they are doing against Christianity.
It is true.
Because, yeah, because they think the Christians, they are not the people who are knowing God. They don't know anything about God. Them, they know more.
It's true. There's only one way a Muslim can know for sure that he's going to paradise according to Muhammad's teaching, and that is if he dies in jihad. If he dies killing non-Muslims, he can go to paradise. But a Muslim is not sure that he will be saved otherwise. In fact, when Muhammad was asked, how can I know for sure that I am going to go to paradise? Muhammad sought Allah as to how many Muslims will be saved. And Muhammad says, and it's revealed in the Quran, that out of every 1,000 Muslims, 999 will go to hellfire. And only 1 in 1,000 will go to paradise. That is what Muhammad taught. Only 1 in 1,000 Muslims will be saved, according to Muhammad, which he says he got straight from Allah. 1 in 1,000. Would you fly on an aircraft that had a 1 in 1,000 chance of arriving alive? And this is actually even worse. We're talking about eternity here. So it's pretty serious. Yes.
Join them, because where they are operating from, they are not that radical. they are part of them. Yeah. Currently, here in Zambia, they are trying to build the largest mosque, the biggest mosque in Africa. And like a nation, which is a Christian nation like that, giving a platform for a place to build such a place, it means they are coming and they are trying to gain popularity and to gain authority. So how do we deal with such people where they are, where we have our Islam?
Of course, the Bible tells us we must always tell the truth. But the Quran does not require its adherents to tell the truth. In fact, Muslims are commanded to deceive others. And so there is this doctrine of lying, of taqwa, where you can intentionally deceive somebody for the good of Islam, for the good of the cause. So a Muslim is commended and commanded actually to deceive. So when a Muslim says, oh, this isn't real Islam and we're not violent and no, we wouldn't do a thing like this, he might be telling the truth, but he might be lying. And so you must understand that the Muslims who in your community and have got shops, of course they want your customers. They want you to come and build up their customers. They want us to buy their oil, they want us to buy their goods, they want us to come and work in the countries that we can do the work for them. So the Muslims, of course, need the cooperation of the Christians when they're the minority. And even when they're the majority, they still need us to do the work, because the Muslims don't do much themselves, as you've noticed. They get lots and lots of foreigners to come into the country and do the work for them. And it's our oil and our technology and our workers that enables them to keep going, really. I should say, it's Christians who found the oil in the Muslim countries like Saudi Arabia, who extracted it, who refined it, who exported it, and who paid them so that they can use our money from our use of their oil to fund all of their weapons. So the Muslims have been using Christians for a long time. And so a certain amount of Muslims who live in our areas, they have to tell us that they're actually peaceful, tolerant, they don't support this. But if Islam became a majority, or they moved to a Muslim country, would they resist this radical agenda? No, they will not. Whether in their heart they agree with it or not, who can tell? But we do know this. The Muslims tend to do what the Muslim leadership tells them to do. They go with the flow. They'll join the mob. They certainly won't stop their Muslim brothers from murdering us. So what good is there saying, oh, I don't support this? If Muslim majority took over and told them this has got to be done, they'd probably be cheering along with the rest or throwing the rocks as part of the mob. I have trouble believing that the average Muslim is going to stand up like a Martin Luther and be courageous to stand against this radical side of Islam.
By the Muslim, we have marching in the place where we were. Getting to the end of last year, there were some ministers that were arrested in Britain for preaching against other religions, and they were taken to court, and they were asked to apologize publicly. So what do you have to say about that? If, like, recently, David Cameron is making an intervention whereby they don't allow people to leave Britain to go and join ISIS, so they're trying to make the security be tight so that because Britain also is a target. Everywhere is a target. So now, why are they giving the Muslim the privilege to do such marching? And when Christians want to talk or make public speaking, they are against it.
Why indeed? It's true. Good question. Very important. Part of it is guilt manipulation, which we will get to. False interpretation of events, misinformation, disinformation, and sheer ignorance. But it's not just that, it's the fact that if a person uses terrorism, it intimidates. So you know how a bully works. Maybe when you were at school there was a bully or some bullies there. They bully you. You do what they want, so they make life miserable for you. I think that's the thing, the Muslims are bullies. And they're able to do bullying in different ways. Like, for example, you write something we don't like, we're going to threaten you. So when I produced the book Slavery, Terrorism and Islam, a book that I'm going to get into your hands, they gave me a death threat fatwa. Fatwa is a judicial statement that every Muslim on earth is obligated to kill you. That was 2005. I produced the book early 2005. By July 2005, I was under a fatwa. So that's 10 years I've had this. And the Muslims, our police said, this is serious. These are the people involved in the 7/7 bombings. They're real players. These are not just people who write the threat and don't follow up. These are serious terrorists. They murder people. And our police force in Cape Town told me I must change my identity. They'll give me a witness protection program. I can disappear and they'll have trouble finding me under police protection. I said, I cannot do it. I'm a missionary. I've got a public ministry. I'm not going to disappear. No. So they said, well, you must know that you're a target and you must always be armed and you must always be ready and you must have bodyguards and you must bomb-proof your windows and your home and your vehicle. And we did what we could. And all of our staff got trained and my family and different things that we need to do. We made things harder for the Muslims to attack us. We put strong gates that they couldn't even drive a truck through and anchored things in and bomb-proofed our windows. We had to do some things because of the Muslim threats. But I'm not going to stop saying what is the truth and exposing Islamic evil. But for some people, they do keep quiet. So you see, that's the way the Muslims work. You are not allowed to tell the truth. If you do, we're going to threaten your life. And of course, they do murder some people. And so I think that's why. I think many of the people in the West are cowards. I think the British government are cowards. I think the British press are cowards. And they pick on the Christians because the Christians are gentlemen. We're polite. We don't murder anyone. You can even insult us and be bad. We won't hurt them. We might argue. We might get out the pen and produce some articles. We might publish some things. We might even go to court, but we don't use violence. And so it's easier for them to pick on Christians and attack us because they know we'll play fair. But they don't dare say anything against Islam, even if it's obviously the truth, because they're afraid of being bullied. So they're cowards. But if we want our countries to stay free, and if we do not want our next generation to be enslaved by Islam, we need to stand up. And I think every woman in particular should be outraged about how Islam treats women. The worst mistreatment of women in the history of the world has been from Islam. It's a disgrace to think that we can put up with what ISIS is doing. Shocking, beyond shocking. They are a bunch of demonic savages. And we as Christians should have backbone. We should be like David going against Goliath. You come with your shield, your spear, and your javelin. I come in the name of the Lord God of Israel, whom you have defied. And so we need to make a stand. We need to fight against what's evil. Any other questions or comments? Now, no, we should have had a break already, but we talked our way in. We're getting close to the lunchtime. I think I'll say a few things about the Crusades and we can do more tomorrow. Okay. Back in 1999, while our mission station was being bombed by the National Islamic Front government in Sudan, friends of mine, fellow missionaries, were organizing reconciliation walks to the Middle East to apologize for the Crusades. Now, at the time, as our churches were under aerial and artillery bombardment by the jihadists, this seemed bizarre. Therefore, I undertook a study of the Crusades and of jihad. The popular misconceptions, the misunderstandings about the Crusades, is the Crusades were, and I'm quoting, aggressive wars of expansion, fought by religious fanatics in order to evict Muslims from their homeland and to force conversions to Christianity. Every point there is false. But that's the common propaganda. The historical record does not support these assertions. The Muslims say the Crusaders' conquest of Jerusalem in 1099 started a millennium of hostility between Islam and the West. Muslims blame the Crusades for interrupting 5 centuries of peaceful coexistence that had elapsed between the political events and an imperial papal power play led to centuries-long wars called the Holy Wars that pitted Christendom against Islam and left an enduring legacy of misunderstanding and distrust. That's the propaganda from Islam. According to Bill Clinton, the violence in the Middle East began with the Crusades. But what preceded the Crusades? What came before the Crusades? The fact is, the Crusades only started after 5 centuries of Islamic Jihad had conquered or annihilated or forcibly converted over 2/3 of what had formerly been the Christian world. The Muslims massacred Christians in Jerusalem when they took Jerusalem in AD 638. They crucified Christians, 60 Christians in Norum. They extorted ransom from pilgrims. They ransacked the most holy churches in Christendom. They demanded exorbitant taxes. They forced Christians to walk with hulking great big crosses around their necks. They increased the penalty taxes or jazars. They forbade Christians to engage in any religious instruction. They could not even teach any religious instruction to their own children. They ordered the hands of Christians in Jerusalem to be branded in 772. They beheaded a monk, slaughtered Christians, plundered monasteries. I document these in the Slavery, Terrorism, Islam book. Waves of destructions of churches, plundering of churches, burning, looting, pillaging. 30,000 churches were destroyed in the century before the Crusades began. 30,000 churches destroyed by Islam in 1 century before the Crusades began. Even the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and the Church of the Resurrection in Jerusalem destroyed by the Caliph al-Hakim. And the Muslims murdered over 3,000 Christians in Jerusalem in 1077. This is before the Crusades began. And so this is the challenge from Pope Urban the Second that launched the Crusades at the Council of Clermont in 1095. The Turks and the Arabs have attacked our brethren in the east and have conquered the territory of Romania, the Greek Empire, as far as the shore of the Mediterranean. They've occupied more and more lands of those Christians that have overcome them in 7 battles. They've killed and captured many and have destroyed churches and devastated the Eastern Empire. If you continue to permit them to continue thus for a while with impunity, the faithful of God will be much more widely attacked by them. On this account, I persuade all men of whatever rank, foot soldiers and knights, poor and rich, to carry out aid promptly to those Christians in the East. Now notice, nowhere in this call for the launch of the Crusades talked about conquest or conversion. They were merely to remove Islamic invaders from lands that had previously been Christian and restore religious freedom to the Holy Lands. That was the goal of the Crusades. It was military, defensive, a reaction to centuries of jihad. So the popular misconception that the Crusades were aggressive wars of expansion to evict Muslims from their homelands is a myth. The truth is the Crusaders were reacting to over 4 centuries of relentless Islamic jihad, which had wiped out over 50% of all the Christians in the world and conquered over 60% of all the Christian lands on earth before one crusade even began. Many of the towns liberated by the Crusaders were still over 90% Christian when the Crusaders arrived. Remember, the Middle East was the birthplace of the Christian church. That's where Damascus was, the road to Damascus. All these places, the 7 churches of Asia and what today is called Turkey, that the book of Revelation begins with. It was the Christians who had been conquered and oppressed by the Seljuk Turks. Many of the towns in the Middle East welcomed the Crusaders as liberators. So far from the Crusaders being the aggressors, it was the Muslim armies which had spread Islam from Saudi Arabia across the whole of Christian North Africa and even France within the first century to the gates of Poitiers in France with the Battle of Tours through the back. And here you can see, what were Saudi Arabians defending in Spain? That's a long way away. So when the Muslims say that jihad was only defensive, nonsense. Muslim armies had sacked and looted and slaughtered away across some of the greatest Christian cities in the world. Alexandria, Carthage, Antioch, Constantinople, massacring the people. In the first 100 years of Islam alone, they destroyed 3,200 churches. Professor Thomas Madden is one of the greatest authorities on the Crusades today. And he says in his A Real Christian, A Real History of the Crusades, the Crusades to the East were in every way defensive wars. They were a direct response to Muslim aggression. They were an attempt to turn back or to defend against Muslim conquests of Christian lands. But Christians in the 11th century weren't paranoid fanatics. Radical Islam was really out to get them. Muslims were gunning for them. Islam was born in war and it grew in war. From the time of Muhammad, the means of Muslim expansion was always by the sword. And so we need to realize the Christian world was a prime target for the earliest caliphs because they liked to live on loot. The Crusades were a response to 5 centuries of conquest in which Muslims had already captured over 2/3 of the Christian world. The London Telegraph points out a more realistic view of history requires less retrospective fantasy and more brainwork. It means forcing your head around to see what motivated men and women centuries ago. Try to think the unthinkable, that the Crusaders were right, and we should be grateful to them. How's that for radical thought? Professor Jonathan Riley Smith is probably the greatest authority on the Crusades in the world, Oxford University professor. He explains that crusading was an act of love for your neighbor, a means of mercy to rectify a terrible wrong. In the words of one of the church leaders at that time to one of the knights, you are carrying out in deeds the words of the gospel. Greater love has no man than this, than that he laid down his life for his friends. Professor Jonathan Riley Smith points out the goals of the Crusaders were first and foremost to rescue Christians of the East. Many thousands of Christians are bound in slavery, imprisoned by Muslims, tortured with innumerable torments. Secondly, they wanted to liberate Jerusalem and the holy places. They saw themselves as pilgrims, restoring to the Lord Jesus Christ his property, his land. So the Crusaders' act of taking Jerusalem was not colonialism. It was an act of restoration. Act of restoration, an open declaration of love for our neighbor and for God. It's often assumed that the central goal of the Crusades was the forcible conversion of the Muslim world, but nothing could be further from the truth. From the perspective of the Christians in the Middle Ages, Muslims were the enemies of Christ and his church, and it was their task to defeat them and to defend against them. That was all. Muslims who lived in Crusader-controlled territories are always allowed to keep their property and their religion. Crusaders weren't taking their religion or their lands. And we often think of the Middle Ages, Europe, in the light of what it became rather than what it was. The fact is, Europe wasn't the military superpower in the Middle Ages. Islam was. The Crusades were a battle against all odds, with impossibly long lines of supply, cripplingly inadequate logistics. These people didn't have a lot of supplies. This is a David against Goliath operation from the beginning. The chance of success was very slim. They had no leader. They had no chain of command. They had no supply lines. They had no detailed strategy. They were just volunteers. Thousands of dedicated warriors marching thousands of kilometers into enemy territory, way behind the lines. Many of the Crusaders died of disease, starvation, and wounds. It was a rough campaign, always on the brink of disaster. Yet it was miraculously successful. By 1898, the Crusaders liberated Nicaea and Antioch to Christian rule. In July 1099, they liberated Jerusalem and began to rebuild a Christian state in Palestine. When Jerusalem fell to Saladin a century later, Christians across Europe perceived that God was punishing them for their sins. And so numerous lay movements, reform movements, like Peter Waldo's Waldensians, sprang up, dedicated to purifying Christian society so it might be worthy of victory against Islam. Professor Madden of St. Louis University and the author of A Concise History of the Crusades has observed, from the safe distance of many centuries, it is easy enough to scowl in disgust at the Crusades. Religion is no reason to fight wars over, we say. But we should be mindful that our Middle Ages ancestors would have been equally disgusted by our infinitely more destructive wars fought in the names of political ideologies today, like the First and Second World War, and all the wars we've done, bombing cities, laying waste to homes. Hideous things done by communist regimes. The greatest killer in history. Massacring, murdering in the name of atheism. So before we get all upset about the Crusades, remember about the Rwandan Holocaust. Remember about what our people do in our time. Whether we admire the Crusaders or not, it's a fact the world we know today would not exist without the efforts. The ancient faith of Christianity, with its respect for women, with its antipathy towards slavery, not only survived but flourished. Without the Crusades, it's doubtful that Christianity would have survived. We could have followed Zoroastrianism and other Islam's rivals into extinction. But for the Crusades, Europe would have become Eurabia. America wouldn't have come into existence. Kenya wouldn't exist. South Africa wouldn't exist. Neither would Zambia. In fact, all of the products of Christianity and of Christian Europe would not exist today if the Crusades had not been successful in throwing Islam back and winning centuries of time for the world. So this business of condemning the Crusaders is foolish. Any questions at all before we go to lunch? Yes.
Is it wrong to come up with a Christian nation?
No, it cannot be wrong or evil to come up with a Christian nation. We need to go for Christian nation. That is exactly what we need to be doing. At the moment, what is wrong is the fact that we are allowing the secular humanists to take our nation. This is the book I was referring to. Does anyone have this? Slavery, Terrorism, Islam? Not yet. Well, we must rectify that. We need Christian nations. That is why we've written a book, Biblical Principles for Africa. Because the Bible has the key for freedom, prosperity, for productivity. And if we follow biblical economics, biblical principles for crime and punishment, biblical principles for education, if we work on biblical foundations for families, yes, we need to have Christian nations. Because if we don't have a Christian nation, you'll have an atheist nation, or a humanist nation, or a Muslim nation. You can't have a neutral country. There's no such thing as neutrality. It's going to be some religion or another. And if you don't want to fight for a Christian nation, then you will end up under Islam, or communism, or secular humanism, or atheism. Which, as you know, would be a bad idea. Yes?
Because a teaching which was mentioned in connection with the blaming Zambia being a Christian nation, and the teaching was there is evil, and these are two different entities, cannot go, the government and Christianity cannot go together.
You know, the only people who could say that would be people who did not live under Kenneth Kaunda's socialist humanist regime. For 27 years, the people of Zambia suffered under socialist humanism, which bankrupted the country. People who lived under Zambia before Zambia became a Christian country should remember. Nothing in the shops. Zambian kwacha worth nothing. You couldn't even exchange your money legally. It had to all be through the banks with a totally unreasonable exchange rate. They were stealing from you in every way. The taxes were ridiculous. The oppression. You had to go through 34 roadblocks to get from Livingston to Chapata. 34 roadblocks. And all of them, bribes, theft, pull everything out, stretch it out on the road, take them what they want. Oh, if people want to complain about Zambia being a Christian nation, they need to remember what it was like before it was officially declared a Christian nation. Zambia wasn't perfect. It needed to do a lot more. I think Zambia should have been saying, we are committed to being a Christian nation, and there's a lot more they could have done to make it more Christian, especially the school textbooks and so on. But there was a lot more freedom after 1991. A lot more. Most of the roadblocks disappeared. The banks became free. You could exchange money on the streets. You didn't have to do it through the banks. Shops got full. Lots and lots and lots of things available. People saying, the roads got repaired. You could preach the gospel openly in the schools. Many things changed for the good in Zambia. But I think most forgot what it was like under socialist humanism. And maybe these people are younger than 20. They didn't experience what it was like under Kaunda and his dictatorship and the reign of terror of UNIP. But I was in prison under Kaunda. And the prison was full of people who had never come to trial. There were 1,200 people in Lusaka Central Prison, which the British built for 80 people. And when the British built it, it had plumbing and electricity. When Kaunda was there, he had a room for himself. Kaunda had everything from a gramophone and bed and desk and couch and cooked food three times a day. When we were there, there were 60 to 65 people in every cell, where the British put one person in a cell. There was no running water working, no plumbing, no electricity, and most of the people in that prison had never even been to trial. Some had been there 8 years and hadn't been to trial. That's socialist humanism under Konda. Most people are still in their civilian clothes, the rags that once were closed when they came in, but they hadn't got a prison uniform yet because they were still remand. They hadn't come to trial. Some people, I knew one man there had been there 8 years and he hadn't gone to trial yet, hadn't had his day in court, but he's still in prison as a remand prisoner 8 years later. That was socialist humanism. In our prison cell with presidential detainees, there's an Indian man who'd had his mine confiscated and they threw him in jail. He hadn't done anything wrong. There's a Malian, a man from Mali who's a businessman, and they just decided to steal everything from him and threw him in jail. Nobody had been to trial in our presidential detainee cell. And we were missionaries, and we ended up in there. Tortured 6 times, dragged off there, waterboarded, heads in buckets of urine and filth. That was socialist humanism under Kenneth Kaunda. And if people today want to say, oh, it's bad to have a Christian nation, blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord's. And righteousness exalts a nation. Sinners are a disgrace to any people. General Godfrey Meander was also in Lusaka Central Prison. He knew. Why was he in prison? Because he said, sanctions against South Africa will hurt Zambia more. And for that unpatriotic comment, they threw him in jail. There was a major from the engineers who'd studied at Sandhurst, top military man, in prison because he had said something that was considered critical of the government. How can a country survive under that sort of thing? Zambia was wrecked under Konda. But under Chalupa and Levi Mwanawasa, it soared. The Zambian money strengthened, something that hadn't happened. It had only weakened. And the people could buy things they couldn't buy before. And Christian schools, independent Christian radio stations. Zambia was not perfect, but Zambia was doing a lot better than its neighbors. I remember in the 70s, Rhodesia had full shops and Zambia had empty shops. And in the 90s, Zambia had the full shops and Zimbabwe was heading into disaster. And by the year 2000 and so on, their shops are getting emptier and emptier. So by 2008, Zambia was the rich cousin and Zimbabwe was the poor cousin. It just shows you, according to your religion and your economic principles, whether you're obeying the Bible or not, that's how the countries go. So I believe a lot of good was done by committing Zambia to Christ in 1991. And I think it's sad that they chose in 2011 to go for Patriotic Front. And I don't think it's been a good move. Has Zambia had new elections recently?
Yes.
And the result? Are they still the government? They got voted back in. That's amazing. Yes, they didn't do a very good job the last few years. I'm amazed they got votes again. Yes, any other questions? Tomorrow morning, please remember to bring your manuals. We will start again. And we will take more on the Crusades and on church history. Thank you.